Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm super excited to be in the studio with Stephen Malkmus, who has a new solo album out called Groove Denied. But the question is, what would the album have been called if the groove had not been denied? I can't be the first person to ask that, but I haven't seen the answer anywhere.
Well, that was a working title before some of this Groove Denied narrative started. Already based on some of the ways that I chop beats, you know, I kind of deliberately keep them off the grid and stuff. And so that combined with just maybe sort of a plaint of the modern time, trying to do some, you know, be yourself, and you keep getting pushed like in a Tetris game off to other, actually a different game, whatever one, where you would block paths and, you know, you're led this other way, which wasn't the way you wanted to go. But yeah, and it just, all those things combined with this story of the record being unacceptable for release because of Washington Post journalists, you know, that was really digging for a story, got brought out. But
it's the kind of thing that if it hadn't happened, it actually would have been good to make it up, because it provides a very helpful hook for people to talk about the record.
That's true. Something to talk about besides the music. I mean, it all worked out. In the end, it came out. I'm happy with it. It's not even past tense because we're still talking about it.
There's actually at least one previous song. It's Kindling for the Master, which is like a mid-2000s song, which is actually, let's hear that.
Check out the time. Henry Bombing, kindling for the master, kindling for the master, kindling for the master.
And it's to me, very much in the vein of this record. Is there a connection there?
Well, that was different because that's recorded on tape, and it did have some triggered drums, and it was kind of a lo-fi funk workout by my standards, for sure. You know, I'm trying to remember what I was into when I was trying to do that song, and it just seems that album, which is also another album I made called Face of Truth, it touches on some other genres, but it was mostly me recording myself in a similar way to Groove Denied, although I used other musicians, or I didn't use, I just used them and played them,
tossed them aside,
created with these other people those songs. But that one, I think, is all me by myself, Kindling for the Master. So, but yeah, I can see that in a way. It's definitely in a 80s, 90s, New Jack style compared to the psychedelic rock that I do with my guitar.
I mean, this album is actually, I really, really enjoy it. And I think you may have said this, but there is a thing where it's like using these unfamiliar contexts maybe got you. I don't think you used the Zen term beginner's mind, but there is a little bit of that in there where it feels like a return almost to your first record. There seemed to be a certain freedom there.
I think you're right in terms of, you know, when you're not quite in control of technology and or the instruments you're using, it can bring a kind of old and new feeling together. Like when I was first unself-aware and making music in Pavement, not knowing what it sounds like when it comes out and kind of being a little bit surprised. Of course, after many years and working with the same unit of people and developing a language, you know, there's something of it. It gets a little bit, I wouldn't say like risk averse, but you know, you just, there's so many assumptions you make about what you're doing that you don't even know that you're doing it. And so with something like this, yeah, messing with drum machines and different, really just different instruments and different genres that I haven't publicly tried to conquer.
How are your keyboard skills? Like, are you like a real piano keyboard?
Yeah. Not adept enough that I decided to not, I'm not playing any piano on my live tour. I'm playing some synthesizers. I also didn't want to travel with them because I'm trying to really travel light. But to evade the question, they're pretty basic.
Mm-hmm.
I did it also on this album, Sparkle Hard, like the first song. And like three of the songs, those are piano-based songs that I transposed onto a rock, not transposed, but like started that way and then made them into guitar songs. And
That's like you on the opening track playing piano?
Yeah, it's not me on the actual thing, demo was me.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, you know, like some people would just call that chopsticks, or some would say it's like Neil Young immediate, you know, that's what I'd rather it be. simple, but like effective and stuff. So yeah, I play like the song Grown Nothing. That's me playing. I mean, I could play that live and it would be fine.
Yeah.
I wouldn't make any mistakes.
Let's hear that, 'cause that's a really beautiful song.
Yeah.
Baby, be a dying tree. How will we know
It seems like guitar players can fall into that Neil Young style of like sort of basically you're playing rhythm guitar on the piano.
That's
with a little
true.
Bit of effort.
And, you know, I like jazzy music like Andrew Hill or even Thelonious Monk. You know, I would obviously not say that I'm anywhere near those geniuses, but, you know, like you can kind of think of a piano in that, in these clusters and broken forms. And, you know, we're all striving for something when we're playing. And I guess I go more in that direction.
It's funny that you mentioned that you were unself-conscious or unself-aware making the first Pavement record, because you always seem super self-conscious and self-aware even back then. So I wonder how that, because you always were kind of...
I can say, you know, even if you are, maybe I said that wrong. It's just, it's more like not being in control of what you're doing and, you know, whatever. Whatever came out of the speakers, you're really sort of surprised. So I guess that's what I meant. It's like you're not in control of what you're doing. And also, you know, lyrically, I certainly am not particularly self-conscious, because especially at that time, because, you know, I really just said whatever came out of my mouth, you know, like the first time. So I think maybe that you can call that self-conscious, that you, after the fact, that you kept that. But, you know, a lot of other people might have said, like, what does that mean that I wrote? Is that stupid? Should I even be saying that? I didn't really do that. I just went forward.
Did that start to come in maybe, especially in the last like 20 years, a little bit more of some kind of editor's mentality where you're fighting yourself?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people, well, not only me, there's a combination of reasons that would happen. First of all, you've said what you've said well already, and you need to say it differently or something in a way that is not just tired. And then also the world catches up with you, or it's very fast the way the world is, and other people are doing cool stuff that influences you or that makes your old ways of working. There's a reason that they sounded fresh back then, but don't now if you tried to do it. And why would you want to anyway? Once something's been done, it's time to move on and try to make some new forms and connections. So...
I know you're not a huge Dylan guy, even though he did several songs for that soundtrack that are happen to be great, but he once said he was in the studio like in the 80s or something. Not a great Dylan period. I'm in no way making a comparison. But he was in the studio and the producer was like, well, why don't you actually just do it, you know, guitar and harmonica? And Dylan's like, no, that's how Bob Dylan would do it. You know, so it is that thing where you become aware.
Yeah, that's probably what happens. And it's quite hard to get outside yourself, right? No matter what, you're kind of in a hall of mirrors when you're trying to not do something the way you do it and you're you. No matter what, I think we just all struggle to find a tone that, you know, is like feels good to us, feels good to me. And, you know, I can feel like it's real or authentic.
Listening to, like, it's a classic sort of indie trick to make the first track the really weird one, and Belziger Faceplant, am I pronouncing that correctly? Is like super loopy and maybe what people imagine the whole record would be based on their initial description, and it's really enjoyable. I also imagine that maybe when you described there was a whole bunch of stuff, there's probably more stuff that sounded more like that's not in the record.
Yeah, there is more tunes in that style. That was the best example of that, I thought. And when you're making a sequence for a record, a lot of things, there's a lot of ways you can go, and I can say that, but usually it just comes down to two or three songs that could be the first song. So probably if we had another year even to make the record, it could have been more like that song, for better or worse, or maybe like this one called Forget Your Place. Both of those sort of feel not so referential compared to some things on the record, you know, like either referential to me or other musics that I've liked in the past. So I'm kind of proud of those ones where, you know, at least for myself, I don't really know where they came from except for an idea that they're kind of experimental or something. But I can't say like, oh, yeah, that sounds like Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan or something, or, you know, not my songs. But, you know, like when you're a critic, you spot the influences. And I can't, I'm like, I don't really even know what the influence, it doesn't necessarily mean they're better, but like, I like them better for that reason.
Right. There's moments on this where it's also like, I feel it's a little bit like alternate universe Malcolmist, especially the first half of the record, where it's like, when you first started, I know there were a bunch of like Echo and the Bunnymen influences and stuff, and I almost heard that coming in, just like different directions
it's
you
British.
Could have pursued.
There's definitely a British feel to the first side, and at least the second song,
a bit wilder,
and the third one, Victor Borge. Yeah, that's kind of got an English early post-punk elect with drums creeping into post-punk.
Bauhaus, even.
That too.
Yeah.
I never really loved them so much when I was a kid. I mean, I loved that Bela Lugosi is...
Yeah.
That was just the song we knew about. I'll say Peter Murphy really is aging well. Not that that matters. I've just seen a picture of him. I was like, is that really him? He's like, how come he looks so good? He must not party.
He was one of the last Coachella things where they got an old band to reunite to headline Coachella in this sort of very touching belief that the kids would be very excited about a Bauhaus reunion. And it was awesome. People were there, but I don't really think they knew what it was. They just knew they were supposed to, you know, I think the audience was more open-minded back then at the Coachella thing. Now it's like, it's kids wanting stuff for kids, you know?
I just saw this Duran Duran like video by David Lynch. Did you see that?
No.
So not good. It's it's like a concert of them in 2014. And so it starts with some black and white and David Lynch saying like, Duran Duran, we're gonna, I can't do his accent, but you know how he is.
Yeah.
And then as the concert proceeds, it's a live concert and like some LA corporate venue, which I can't remember which one it is. You know how there's those shows in LA that are kind of, they're just clean. But like, anyway, Lynch just puts like this in the forefront, some kind of like smoke fog, like he overdubs like this kind of smoke fog and light. And then there's like a couple of clocks spinning really fast. It's like generic David Lynch, you know. And then they're playing and you can't even see the band sort of because there's like fake rain in front of them. It's really hack job. No disrespect to either of those artists, but sometimes I don't know what 2014, what was going on. Sorry.
No, you're tempting me to digress about the time I once watched the dudes from Duran Duran try to write a song with Timbaland for 2 hours in the studio. It was the absolute catastrophe. No, I was there.
Really?
I was doing a Timbaland story, and the Duran Duran guys were not excited about me being there, but I was there with their producer. Mm-hmm. So Timbaland just had a loop going. Like, he made a Timbaland loop,
yeah.
And it just, as in the hip-hop style, just kept playing and playing in the studio. That's how they do it. And they were just... They wanted the loop to stop, but that's what they were supposed to write over. And I wish it had been filmed. It was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life, honestly. Those guys were miserable that day.
That was funny.
So I want to take a moment and talk about Vivid Seats. Staying at home is great, but eventually you just got to get out of the house. Whether you go out to see your favorite band or go cheer on your favorite team in person, you got to get out of the house. You got to have a night out. And with Vivid Seats, you can attend the concert of your choice, the sports event of your choice, whatever event you're looking for at a great price. Vivid Seats is the top source for tickets for all the live events you might want to go to. On their site, you can sort by price or look for seats in the section and row of your choice. You can pick the seat you want. To make things even better, Vivid Seats is giving listeners an exclusive promo code for new customers to receive 10% off your first ticket order to save even more money. Just go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. First-time customers can use promo code Rolling Stone, that's RollingStone, for 10% off your first Vivid Seats order. Every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee, from the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more. Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app and enter promo code Rolling Stone for 10% off your first order on Vivid Seats. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime and let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. What did you learn from, I mean, you've worked with, obviously, Nigel Godrich, and you said a really funny thing, which is your records weren't like Radiohead records where everything's great from start to finish, that it's more about attitude and stuff. It's just Nigel is obviously the guy, the collaborator there. So what did you take away from that work with him?
Working with Nigel? Yeah. Well, I was like blown away, obviously, like so many people by OK Computer, and that's all I think. I don't think Kid A was done yet. Can't remember.
That's right.
But, you know, that record sounds so cool, just the sound of it. So just getting to know him and how he worked and how he grew up in a classic British working at Rack Studios and with John Leckie and being a tea bringer up to. It's kind of old school, I guess, the way he learned to do it. And then he's, kind of a mad scientist. So I took that from it more than anything, just seeing how a record is properly made in a certain way. You know, I didn't entirely know.
What surprised you the most about that proper record-making process?
Well, it's like just the obsession with, I get obsessed with making stuff good too, but you know, it's just like really dialed in and obsessed with making, like just living this record, Terror Twilight, 1,000%, you know, that's what he did and does. And maybe I caught him at a good time. He had also just done this, he was really excited about Beck Mutations, which is a really cool record. And he should be, you know, but there's like the song called The Diamond Bollocks. It's like an extra song on the album. I think it was different, but you know, that's the one he was really excited about. He liked other songs on the album, but you know, he was like in, I'm not saying that anything in Rainbows, they're all fantastic, but you know, you catch people at a certain when they're really like young and hungry, or at least 30 something and hungry. And it was like a good, so that's all I just remember that about it.
And then, you know, I think it's 2011, you work with Beck. Again, like what sort of like lessons did you draw? Because that seems like someone with a very different kind of, some similarities, but some real differences in the process and the way he thinks, I think.
Everyone's different. He's a very obsessive music person, into sound as sound, and seems more than me interested in technology or, you know, how to make things sound good. So if you notice, he's worked with, Beck did like Nigel Godrich and Danger Mouse. And I don't really know who Greg Kurstin is, but I can say his name.
Yes.
But they're like known for being, they're all like sound masters and probably have some secrets, you know, like they're almost in that people have their tricks or something that they don't release or something to the world, which I thought was kind of cool too, because I would have never thought of that. You know, I just think it's like plug in and compress it or twist the knobs till it like sounds cool. I don't know if you have like secret boxes or secret moves. So yeah, I thought that was interesting. He's got some secret moves. And again, he's somebody that really is into mastering too, really heavily. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with a guy named Bob Ludwig, but he's kind of
I've talked to him a bunch of times. He's a great guy. Yeah.
He's really nice.
Yeah.
He lives up in Maine and he has super expensive mastering and he does like an amazing job. So, I mean, it's all those little things. Like, there's so many. It's just about the music and the box, you know, like getting the best sound for posterity. Both of those guys are like that. And so maybe they like to work with someone a little bit like me, who's more of a primitive, you know, caveman in comparison with that stuff, for sure.
You mean with like Sonics and that kind of thing? Is that,
I love all that stuff. I like pedals. But the proof's in the pudding if you listen to the records. not like that.
Something about these two 90s names reminded me of the fact that two things. You retweeted a tweet by Rivers Cuomo about him making a somewhat inscrutable joke about whether anyone ever asked him if he sounds like Malkmus. Mm. And then you also said in an interview once, when people, I think, frequently have asked you, you know, do you wish you had bigger hits? Did you try to write bigger hits? Blah, blah, blah. And you said, well, that's the difference between Weezer and Pavement. So just like, how do you see that band? Because that is, they're weirdly like this weird opposite of Pavement. Someone who were never on
just
a,
the time,
you know?
When, I think when they first started, I mean, this is really like internecine indie rock, DGC, Sonic Youth, The Breeders, The Buzz Bin. I mean, it's like 2 years, you know, when things...
Right.
I mean, at that time, they had like a Spike Jonze video with like dogs running through it. And then it felt kind of Pixie Pavement-y. And...
Except instantly wildly successful.
Yeah, and but they're really catchy songs. Like, I like that song, Say It Ain't So. I'm a fan of that song.
Yeah.
And the band in general. So they just kind of came out of nowhere and there was a bit of a, you know, like there's... whatever, just the tribal indie stuff. You know, there's bands that were on Matador or Homestead or Sub Pop. And then some groups just started right away in Los Angeles on David Geffen Company or something, you know. So some were suspicious. But it doesn't really matter. Music's music, right? So
it's, right. It sort of seemed to matter back then.
It's a younger, sweeter time when people actually had time to, worry about credibility, or we hadn't really gotten into psychology of, status and posing and all these things that indie culture had back then, and people didn't question.
Well, the other thing, and I kind of always say this, people who listen to the show have probably heard me say this before, but back when rock sort of more ruled the world, the distinctions between kinds of rock seemed very important, and perhaps less so here in 2019.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. That was probably 94.
94, but,
Yeah, it was a bigger market for it, and it was the genre, too, so of the marketplace a little bit more. Of course, there was R&B and hip hop, but rock and roll was still, it still felt like it was evolving against something. I don't know. There was hair metal and Guns N' Roses and with the, I'm just talking like white guy guitar rock, really, And so that was a,
let the record show that you were strumming, you were strumming an air guitar at that moment.
people were like young or, it was like, ugh, why is that? That needs to go, And
right.
So, it was really exciting when Nirvana, for better or worse, when Nirvana, which had some hard rock signifiers in their music, but it was definitely different. And, when that took off, it felt like a big, it was really pretty exciting, I thought.
And yet you never wanted to fully ride that particular wave.
Well, I'm glad that we rode in the slipstream of it,
exactly,
so it's not.
Yeah.
And there's, you can make a comparison. I mean, if we're just talking about like REM, that was another group that was older, but it's kind of cool. And, it's like you could just be singular and be popular. It's a kind of band that sort of not aligned to a scene. A scene was made around them. I mean, maybe they did come from the Paisley Underground or Jangly College Rock, whatever they came from. But who wouldn't want to be like REM, like writing these big hits and have nice house, three houses and stuff like that. A big Warner Brothers contract. That would have been nice.
To return to this record for a minute, it is one of those things where, as we said, the first half is more electronic and then it nicely slides into more of a traditional you thing. But again, totally homemade. You play every instrument,
mm-hmm.
drums. I think even going back to Pavement songs, there's songs where you played drums, mm-hmm. right? So you're a decent drummer, I guess?
No. Not decent, but that's the charm of it, hopefully. I mean, it's not like the Shags or something, but really.
Do you loop? Do you play live?
Those are all the way played through, all those songs, I will say. Maybe a couple of fills. I did MIDI a couple of fills just after I did it, just to see if it would sound different and better. But they are all the way played through, which is, that's good. A couple of them have drum machines, though. Shouldn't be hard to play drum. I mean, the drums should stay out of the way, kind of, and I feel bad saying that with having drummers and stuff. They don't want to hear that. But, it's kind of like, you can listen to my history, work history. The drums are kind of, they just should get a good groove going. No disrespect to drummers. And all the great drummers know to say the song is the king or they don't get jobs.
Right.
Or they can start their own bands or whatever.
You promised no guitar solos on this record to some interviewer, and there's
not many, though.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Few guitar solos.
Which ones?
Well, especially on Grown Nothing, there's a really beautiful guitar solo.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's kind of the one, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. There is some messing around on guitar. And as it turns out, when I play these songs live, there's going to be a lot of messing around on guitar because, in the end, you have to do what you're comfortable and good at in a certain way if people are paying to see you. So
you're going to be standing alone on a stage.
Yeah, I got a laptop and one of those OP-1s and guitar and a bunch of pedals.
Have you done one of these shows yet or no? They're coming.
No, I did. Yeah. I did a... I've done, not with guitar, I opened for Animal Collective at a previous time, just with a laptop and a microphone, and I opened for Ann Magnuson and a Bongwater reunion, doing the same thing, but that was at a previous time, how we were talking about when the record could have been more like the first song. Yeah. It didn't go down that well. But I mean, I was playing to normies and art people that, you know, it was like a $10 show of people who, it doesn't, you know what I mean? So they're free to vent their opinions were not, they weren't on my side to begin. It was, I wouldn't say it was like doing a, you know, Bernie talking at a Trump rally or something, but it was.
Are you going to feel comfortable right away?
No.
They've done it, yeah.
Would you?
It seems a little awkward. I've seen, what's Martin, the dude from Suicide, Martin Rev, I saw him do completely comfortable, just get up with a DJ backing him and just like with a, you know, just be out there. But he was a lunatic.
Yeah, my friend said that he, you know, he tried to make me feel better about it. He had seen Greg Sage of the Wipers and with just a drum machine. And he said it was one of the best shows he ever saw. But that doesn't really establish confidence. You know, that's like, so what? This guy is really great, did something great that way. And now I'm going to, you know, it doesn't. It doesn't work that way. I know what he meant, though, you know.
So, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, why are you touring this way? It obviously matches the record, but is it to challenge? It's the same idea as the record, just to be a challenge? Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, it's a good question. You know, I'm going to, as it's coming up in the day, I ask the same question. But the fact of the matter is, yeah, I wanted to try. I've challenged myself, and is there anything else there, like, that I can do that's cool? So, I don't know. No real good answer for that.
It may set a personal record for me. I think the last time I interviewed you was, I looked it up, was like February 2001 when your first solo record came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And yeah.
Those are different times.
Those are different times. And how has the 21st century so far compared to like your, I mean, you know, not world historically necessarily, but like your life in this, these last like 18 years, that's your whole stretch of your solo career and stuff with the Jicks. Mm-hmm. And a reunion and a family and everything has happened in these 18 years. So how has this compared to like sort of what your expectations were for this part of your life and career?
I don't know. That's a big question.
I know.
I don't think anybody has a real concept of what it's going to be like. I mean, once you obviously, when you have a family and kids, that completely is something that you're not prepared for. And there's no way to really compare expectations to that myself. So music is forever. It just carries on. You know, I'm a fan of music, and it's not a struggle to want to like it or something. You know, it's not like homework or anything. I just like to do it. It's not something, I don't know what you do for entertainment. Everyone's got their thing, but it's hard for, I mean, it's a little bit of a capitalist cliche or something, but you know, like you love your work or whatever. Of course, I want to be rewarded for my labor, but it doesn't, I don't mind it, you know, so that's all I can really say about it. Whatever comes from it has been, there's the interviews and the travel, that's a different thing, but just making, I'm not saying it's work though, or whatever, but it's just making noise and sounds, entertainment to me.
Obviously, around the time we were talking about in 94 or so, you lyrically bid farewell to the rock and roll era, famously. And it, you know, you were a few years ahead of time, but we did get there. And it's
Yeah, it is over pretty much. That's all right, though. Doesn't matter. It's still going, too.
Well, the super...
So it's not over. I mean, it's just maybe to a Coachella audience or something, it's over.
Does it affect the way, I mean, obviously here you are, have made a record with a lot of different sounds and in a more modern way. So obviously it does affect the way you, it has affected your music making process. And here you are off touring like a DJ too, to get some of that sweet.
Half DJ.
I
mean, it's okay. I've always liked niche things anyway. So I feel like the music I've made is always, it's always been left to center, and people are always going to be like, what was that? I don't, you know, I never expected any different. All the music I would make would always, I mean, it's nice that Rolling Stone wants to talk to me and stuff, but like came from the underground. So it's all kind of underground stuff. And
it's also like by not having some enormous MTV hit, although you did, you know, you were on there, but there's a freedom in that as well. You're not locked in people's minds the way people don't realize the extent to which it actually could be a curse to have a huge hit in the 90s.
That could be, but even if you did, I mean, you just gotta lead by example. I mean, just lead with your heart and do what you like to do, right? Scott Walker recently passed away, and obviously he was a much bigger star than Pavement ever was, but I guess it hurt him or something in his own mind, but you know, he made the music he wants to make, and Of course, I think you're right. I mean, I think that it's a better play to be, you know, you'd rather be like Iggy Pop than like Three Dog Night, even if Three Dog Night made more money and more people have heard them. And maybe even they made some good songs. It's generally assumed, even by people that don't even know who Iggy Pop is, really, that that's a better person to be in our society, right? Like,
plus, he's like 70 years old and he's like crazy ripped. So,
yeah.
Know, so,
yeah. I'm just saying to be a little bit no, in, in a paradigm of artsy doesn't pander. I mean, Iggy had his times trying to make hits too. So, but you know what I mean? You'd rather totally. Be in that realm of consciousness than in Three Dog Night. I don't know why I mentioned them. No one even knows who they are anymore.
You got me probably. Thinking about it. At the same time, I'd be interested to know what it was like to be in Three Dog Night at the
same
time.
Well, you can read the biographies.
Yeah, there we go.
I know there's a lot of gonorrhea involved.
As the fact that it slipped back into this record shows, you clearly still love the guitar, although you resist the term deadhead.
It's a positive noisemaker, and I like it, and that's all good. Anything that makes good sounds, I'm into. Obviously, keyboards have a different way, or like modular synthesizers and stuff, you know, they have a texture to them, and like this, not only what they symbolize, which is obviously half of what's important about them, I think, that it's electronic and modern and... But also, it's like just the way it sounds, gloopy and bloopy and attack and LFOs and the way that you play with them. It's going to lead you to different emotions. I don't know. Sound kind of silly.
No.
That, but you know what I mean? It's just got different sounds. So I'm for both of those instruments. I'm just not into ukuleles.
Yeah.
Unless it's like traditional Hawaiian music. Mm. Just every instrument is good.
Minus ukuleles. Yeah.
Kind of. I don't mind it as a gateway towards people learning about music and stuff, but, you know, as a first tool, but not as a, I mean, Tiny Tim maybe, but.
You said that the best Neil Young album is Zuma, and I really agree with you. And I never thought of the connection. I know you like him as a guitar player, but once I heard you say that, I was like, well, you know, like I listen to Danger Bird or something. And actually, I hear you in there. There's a connection there.
He's great. Obviously, we all, everyone's pretty on board with Neil, right? And the lyrics are often not always great, but many of them are kind of just stoned epiphanies and like kind of want that. I want that.
It's actually weirdly, I think he's the exact opposite of you lyrically sometimes because he's always just whatever he's writing about, he just comes out and says it. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And it's, you know, you're not always obfuscating what you're writing about, but, you know, certainly.
Well, I do. I mean, I think in some ways I also do that. You just don't know it. you know, it's like, I just want to get the lyrics done usually, you know, like you probably talk to a lot of artists. There are some people that are lyrics first and are really confident about their lyrics. I bet Neil's not particularly confident about his lyrics either. I have no idea, you know. I think he just does it and I'm projecting again. I think, you know, he just wants to get to like jamming. I'm sure he has things to say, don't get me wrong, but like maybe more than, you know, like environmental causes or corporate, this note's for you or something. You know, he just seems like a cool cat. And in the whole scene of the LA, that really fertile time of LA music, you know, you got this Canadian stoner dude in Malibu and Dave Briggs and stuff. It just, that seems like maybe it's a little bro-ish or something at times in retrospect, like Stupid Girl and stuff. But like,
yeah, for sure.
You know, it's still like, seems like I probably would like to be hanging out over there, like drinking tequila, looking at the sun setting and smoking joints and stuff. I don't know. Sounds fun.
After a gap of a few years, this is now two really strong albums in a row. And it seems like I know that your label chief is talking about sort of like reintroducing you and that kind of thing. Is that in your mind too? Are you on a kind of like a reset button thing and just kind of, I mean, you're out there a little bit more. How do you see all this and where do you see it going from here?
I don't really know. I mean, I had a mini plan with this record and that one and one in the future perhaps that will be like three styles. And yeah, that's all. You know, it's not really, it's up to the suits to decide that stuff, right? I mean, we're just the music makers and take what we can get. But yeah, I mean, at least creatively, yeah, I have some ideas of things I want to do. I had a little more time. My kids are older, and there was just, it's a lot of just nuts and bolts. Like, there also the studio situation opened up in the town that I was living at, where I was actually excited to work in a specific building, you know. Then I'm not saying there's everywhere is bad in Portland, but like I had played it out a bit. And so like, if I wanted to go to make a record, I was going to have to go somewhere else always. And so like, there's this brief window where this cool place opened and felt new. And I get inspired by things and situations as much as interior. So that got me working a little bit more.
Do you see yourself as a lifelong musician at this point? Or you're just going to kind of...
It's hard to think of changing. As you know, like, you got to pay your dues, you know, in any... I mean, I don't have much other skills, to be honest. You know, if we're really being real about it, most of them are involved in music. You know, like, I'm not writing. I haven't written, like, a paragraph, a cogent paragraph since like Twitter was invented. You know, it's like I haven't had to.
Yeah.
You know, it's like two sentences, like half with shitty grammar. People like that. So yeah, it's not, I think, probably sticking around. I can't be a like George Martin investing in Meow Wolf or something, you know. It's like
there's always the memoir.
Yeah, that's true. Ugh. The fallback. No, I know those could be interesting, but yeah, I don't have skills. And like, you have to be a waiter, or not a waiter, but like the nice bartender, you know, that the people like Mark from Pavement was a bartender.
If you had to rank the chances of ever playing with Pavement again, where would you put that?
You know, realistic, anything's possible, all alive,
knock one,
good canon. And if there's interest, you know, that's always a factor.
Yeah.
You know, if people are really psyched about it, I'd be psyched about it too. So we'll see. Never know.
Stephen Malkmus, thanks so much for being here. It's awesome talking with you.
Nice talking to you too.
So this
18 years.
This has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt. We'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.